Hey, everybody, welcome to another Commission podcast. This one is for the 1944 film noir movie Laura, which was commissioned to us by one Sarah Shugas. And we appreciate your support, Sarah, and we appreciate the commission. This movie stars Gene Tierney, Dana Andrews, and Clifton Webb, and a very young but still very vocally recognizable Vincent Price. They had the credits for the name, but did you actually get that this is Vincent Price in the movie?
No.
Interesting, because I picked out I smoked his voice right away. Like I couldn't believe how fucking tall Vincent Price is. I looked it up, and he's 6'4".
He plays the love interest of Laura, right?
Yeah, the kind of the okay. Kentucky dandy.
Okay, yeah. Now that you say it, yes. Okay, got it.
Like, he's got that kind of hint, like, he's not full-on horror show version Vincent Price. He's still leading man Vincent Price, but it's definitely all there. And it's based on a 1943 novel, Laura, by Vera Cosperi, which I thought is interesting. Like, every time you go back to these, like, movies that are based on books, like, you think of, like, as old books, but, like, they had contemporary classics just like we do. Like, this is essentially Gone Girl in 1944, you know, hit book, bestseller, captured the public's imagination. Here's the movie version of it. Did this movie capture your imagination, Jim? What did you think of it?
Not completely. I mean, I notoriously don't care much for the filmmaking style of these early films, so it's a really big hurdle to get over personally with me if you're asking me to watch like a 1940s movie,
right?
Or really anything before the era of like early 70s. Like,
so say Godfather. I think it's Godfather. Like,
yeah it pretty much is.
Everything before Godfather is just bullshit.
For the most part, yeah, in my mind. So it's a big hurdle for me to actually come away from a movie impressed that was made in the 40s, which I will say I didn't come away like thoroughly impressed with this movie. It didn't bore me to tears either. I think it has what I would call flaws looking back from a 2018 perspective, but I don't have enough historical context. I'm not well-versed enough in these old movies to tell you whether or not this movie holds up for its time. Unfortunately,
it's interesting because I've got like a slightly different experience than you, because I'm gonna compare this movie a lot to Maltese Falcon, which is kind of like the first cinematic film noir movie starring Humphrey Bogart. And I was amazed at how much more modern it felt than Maltese Falcon. And to the extent that I was thinking like maybe Maltese Falcon was like made in 36 or 37. But I was shocked to find that it was actually released in 1940. It's only 4 years junior to this. But, like, and you can see in Maltese Falcon where there's some fairly modern flourishes, especially in the dialogue, but the acting is still pretty stagey. And, oh, my God, the editing. The editing is, like, I've used this analogy before, but, like, in Maltese Falcon, you'll see Sam Spade take a phone call, hear the conversation, tell his secretary, all right, I'm going down to the police station, dollface, go over to the coat rack, put on his coat, put on his hat, go through the door, other side, out the door, go to the elevator. Elevator opens up in the lobby, walks across the hotel the thing to his car, gets in his car. Like, in a modern movie, he would just, like, they'd fade cut from the phone call right to him talking to the detectives down at the police station.
Yeah.
But, like, it's this weird thing of, like, well, we got, you know, can't lose the audience. And that, most of the editing I saw in this movie doesn't show any signs of that. But I was doing some research, and like this was a real hotbed of like modern movie pioneering techniques. Like Alfred Hitchcock had just storyboarded the first film in 1940.
Okay.
So like the idea that you would actually storyboard to account for things you could do on a camera that you couldn't do in like a stage play is a very new idea, and that's something that the Maltese Falcon director cobbled, and it's something that the director and producer of Laura cobbled together too. And I felt like the blocking and the editing and the acting was much more natural in this film But the dialogue, unfortunately, I felt like the lead detective, the McPherson character, is a pale shadow of Humphrey Bogart, number one, even with Humphrey Bogart stilted and not quite got the acting thing figured out. And I don't think the dialogue is nearly as good. Like, there is some really world-class crackling dialogue in Maltese Falcon that, I don't know, like, there's some stuff, like, obviously the thing, like that Waldo Leidecker's saying is supposed to be good. He's supposed to be, like, urbane and cultured and mannered and witty, but it doesn't quite translate in my mind.
No, I'm with you. Most of what he's saying seems frightening to me. You know, a man all about himself and his ego and manipulating this woman. 95% of the things he says in this movie turn me off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very odd fellow because...
Yeah. I mean, scene one with him tells you that he's an odd fellow, right? He's taking a fucking meeting with a cop in his bathtub.
Right.
In his bathtub. What? I mean, the manners it takes to do that are non-existent, and it's also just weird.
Yeah, and he gives him a full spread of Leidecker's Waldo, and he gets up, and there's, like, a weird chemistry to that scene, because this is so, like, this is 44, but I think you're supposed to understand that Waldo Leidecker is, like, a Capote type that's not entirely straight. He might be, like, I'm trying to be sensitive about this, but, like, I think he's portrayed as a gay stereotype in an era where you couldn't just say, this guy's gay.
Huh, okay.
And the way he was fascinated with Laura was with her breeding and her, like she was his living doll that he could, like, put all of his hopes and fears and stuff onto. It's just a very odd relationship. But it's never felt sexual, which makes it, you know, kind of, I don't know, kind of odd the way he fixated on her.
Yeah, I agree. Everything he was doing in this movie felt very strange.
But there's also a lot of, like, a lot of these characters, like, how do you, you know, these are all wealthy socialite type characters. Like, Vincent Price, you're supposed to understand, is kind of like new money guy from Kentucky that doesn't have much breeding or name, and he's trying to, like, cobble on to these other wealthy women. And there's a whole lot of things that are understated at the beginning of this movie because of the society's taste and sexuality that I found confusing, but I felt like maybe audiences contemporary would just know. Like, the fact that I didn't get that Vincent Price was essentially this wealthy older woman's gigolo until, like, the third act, when it's like, okay, I understand the dynamic and why this is sketchy now. I thought that she was, like, what's that guy from, like, Pride and Prejudice? It's like, that's just, like, his rich relative or something that he was, you know, getting away from Kentucky to do boarding or finishing school or whatever. Like, I had no idea there was a romantic side of that relationship.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's definitely romantic. I picked up on that pretty early. And I think the thing with Vincent Price's character is that he is very down on his luck. Like, he lost all of his money or something.
Oh,
and now he's, you know, in the eyes of Waldo, he's, you know, trying to capture the wealth of Laura, you know, and essentially all of the work that Waldo has done to make her this star and this very wealthy person in his own eyes. Right. Cause he would give himself all the credit for making Laura who she is.
Right.
And so he sees that as this guy trying essentially to latch onto him and to find his wealth, find his way back to wealth through Waldo, which is strange and gross.
Before we get too much further, as I mentioned, this podcast was commissioned by Sarah Sugas, and she has a couple of comments that we want to get to. She says, I guess my main takeaway from this movie is how creepy I found the main detective falling in love with Laura's picture. It was very creepy and not healthy at all. Then he's just all over real Laura and so possessive of her, and I could just never get behind them together, which is why I was glad that the movie ends, from what I remember, without them being confirmed to be together, so I'm going to assume that they weren't. I don't know. Like, it's certainly not like they're leaving for the honeymoon or anything like that.
Right, and I agree with how creepy it all feels. It does feel like, oh my god, when he's in her house by himself and he's looking around, I'm like, this is just a stalker. This is not a detective doing his job. This is a man creeping.
Right, right. It's like, just like if he, like, it had been too much for 1940s, but like if he picked up her panties and started sniffing it, that's kind of, that's the 1940s feel I was getting with that scene.
Yeah.
She continues, on the other hand, I did love her mentor because he was so witty and fun, even though his possessive entitlement was worse. And he literally killed someone and tried to kill another person twice. He kind of stole the show for me, though. I couldn't figure out why the detective let him hang out in his investigation. we'll talk more about this gentleman. But yes, he does pretty much steal the show in the scenes that he's in. Sarah continues, I'm constantly surprised with how strong and independent I find women in 1940s movies are. I don't know if it's because I'm expecting so little from them, given that it's the 1940s, that anything blows me away. Like how excited whenever Nigel Bruce Watson correctly uses a four-syllable word because the bar is just not that high. Or because the woman characters, while still being beholden to their society, did get to be strong and independent in a lot of ways. I did love Laura as a character, except for one part. Her housekeeper, who absolutely loves her and was shattered by her death, discovers that she's alive and is so overwhelmed and breaking down, and Laura just casually tells her to finish breakfast and stop crying. Like, she is normally way more caring than that. And I think maybe it's a class thing. So, yeah, I mean, the housekeeper, I didn't have on her notes, on my notes, to make her a topic of discussion. Mm. But, I don't know. I guess I'm with Laura. She's a little bit out there.
Yeah, sure.
And that was like, it is probably a class thing, because, like, I know this is, like, in Downton Abbey a lot, like, very strong emotion is delivered with a stiff upper lip and a glance away from the subject, and, you know, like, the slightest misting of eyes before those are locked behind iron curtains, like, and I feel like American upper class is largely, like, reflected version of what they think the British aristocracy is.
Sure. I mean, less than 200 years removed, how do you even tell the difference?
Right. But with a slight inferiority complex, because no matter what, we're the new country and we're the new money, and, like, it will never, we'll never actually get real castles and shit, you know? But, like, yeah, that all makes sense. Like, that rigid emotional control and that kind of those affectations would play into that. So, like, I talked about, like, the fact that this Dana Andrews guy who plays the detective McPherson, unfortunately, is not Humphrey Bogart, but, like, he is like the center to everything, and, like, all these other colorful characters kind of dance around. Because say what you will about Clifton Webb's performance as this Lydecker, it's extremely interesting and, you know, noteworthy. And it kind of, like, there's like big broad performances in the Maltese Falcon. Like, there's that gangster guy that kind of talks like this, boss. Yeah. And, oh, and, like, that's like a larger than life. But, like, at no time do you ever think Sam Spade is getting overshadowed by these bozos. Like there's all these colorful characters, but Sam is not exactly colorful, but he's, like, managing the whole thing, where this detective feels like he kind of gets lost in the background when Vincent Price is sparring with this flamboyant, you know, camp character. Like, you just, like, forget that he's even there. And I felt like that, like, this guy, like, film noir needs a kind of a sturdy, cooler dude in the middle of it. And they tried to, I was kind of excited because they talk about, like, this guy's been in a shootout with a gangster and he's, like, a straight arrow type. He's been shot up and he's scarred and he's wounded. I'm like, oh, there's probably going to be some badass stuff in the end. Not really. There's a gunfight, but it's a very perfunctory and staged one.
Yeah.
But I wish the star had a little bit more magnetism.
Yeah, I could see that. I thought, you know, for the actor they were working with, they did a pretty good job of making him kind of the anchor of it. I did always feel like he was the center and everything was kind of revolving around him. It's interesting too, because that character seems to have some kind of love interest with Laura as well. There's a scene where Lydecker
comes out of nowhere.
Right. He's at one point, it had me questioning whether he was actually a cop or just posing as a cop. And he's some obsessed fan of Laura's, right? Like, he goes into her house. He starts, like, rifling through things. And I mean, maybe that's the job of the detective. Maybe he should be there doing that. But also it felt a little indulgent.
He's feeling her personally. Clothes. And when he starts smelling her perfume.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt pretty gross. And then Lydecker, I think, points it out, right? Waldo comes in and he says, oh, right. You're just some obsessed fan or whatever. And
yeah,
I started to question, like, what is this character really? Is he a detective? Or, and by the end, you know, he is a detective, but
you know,
I do also feel
that.
Like it was a little weird.
I never thought that, but you're right. Like, a staple of a film noir scene is going down to the station and, like, sweating somebody or being sweated. Which I guess there was that one scene where he did take her down, like, Laura down and, like, put the... Why do they always shine a light at people?
I don't know.
Like, is that... Was that the... Because I've always heard that what they did is, like, they take a phone book and beat you with it, you know? Or, like, that's what throwing the book at you was, is, like, not every charge, but, like, literally taking, you know... And because you wouldn't hit a victim with you wouldn't hit a perpetrator, a perp with your fists. That's uncivilized. But you beat the shit out of him with a phone book. Like, was that just like the genteel 40s Law and Order way of being like, oh, this is the interrogation of cop. It's like, hey, shine the light of justice on you, cockroach, and you sing.
Right.
I don't know. But yeah, it's like there's nothing that really inherently identifies him as a police officer until the rest of his squad shows up.
Yeah.
Later on, he's not in uniform, he's a detective. That's the other kind of violation of film noir. It's like, I always feel like you have to be a private dick in those things. You have to have like that uneasy half of you is in the underworld, half of you is in the overworld, whatever the fuck you'd call it.
Yeah, this is more like Dick Tracy. Was Dick Tracy an actual cop?
That's a good question. Is Dick Tracy film noir, or is he just a comic book character?
A little of both, I think.
Yeah.
A little of both.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the, I can see what you mean about like him be like thinking that there's a plot twist coming, because
right.
The thing the film does do effectively is keep the plot twist coming. Like,
yeah,
I cycled rapidly throughout the film for the like six primary like potential antagonists, and kind of did it repeatedly, because, the more they reveal, the more it's like, okay, well, maybe it's this rich heiress who's jealous of all the attention that Sheldon's getting or Shelby's getting. Or maybe it's this guy who's upset, clearly obsessed with Laura. Or like it's early in the third act, I'm starting to suspect Laura herself.
Uh-huh.
Which, spoilers for all this movie, if you hadn't figured out already. But like, it was kind of mine. I did like the scene where Laura just comes back, has no idea that people think that she's been killed.
Well, they did a weird camera trick, I think, to show like the passing of time. But I took it as maybe this was a dream sequence.
Same here.
And
yep.
So Laura walks in and I'm like, well, is the cop dreaming or not? And eventually, especially, like 20 minutes passes and you're like, okay, this can't be a fucking dream. It's
right,
too long
right,
of a
right,
sequence.
Right. Especially since like he had been drinking, he's been rifling through all of her personal stuff. He falls asleep under this giant picture of her. It does other than going doodaloo, 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 right. The movie's doing everything it could to tell you that this is potentially a fantasy sequence, or, you know, I also really enjoyed everyone's reaction. Like, her housekeeper Bessie just screaming, Lydecker fainting flat on his face in shock. Which, now, because, like, you know, I've only seen this movie once. That seems an odd reaction, because he knows, or wait, I guess
he
didn't
thinks
know
he killed
that he
her.
Didn't kill Laura.
Yeah, he thinks he killed her.
Because it was dark. Person
Which,
took her model friend takes a step into the house and he's blast her in the face with both shotgun blasts. And in 1944, apparently, if you didn't have a face, forensic science was helpless to identify you.
I guess so, yeah.
But I guess if she's... So they're both white girls. They're both, like, beautiful.
One's had her face blasted off.
One of the face, but they're both also close enough in stature that they can borrow each other's clothes. So
Maybe.
That is not, they don't have, what, they can't do a blood test, they don't have fingerprints on them, maybe?
No, I was prepared to call bullshit on this thing of, like, identical body swapping until they revealed, and maybe they revealed this earlier, but that she was shot in the face. And I was like, okay,
with a
shotgun blast from close range in the face, you're not going to be able to identify that person by their face. So
No.
Can we go real quick back to, like, this idea of keeping you guessing the whole movie? Because I do feel like... That's one of the things that sort of put me off this movie, is they use a lot of red herrings in this movie, just like a ton of them. And it seems like maybe that era of film relied more heavily on that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe today, when I see a really good mystery today, I see the subtlety of the clues. Mm-hmm. They're very particular about what information they reveal and when they reveal it. This movie seemed like it was just throwing everything at you, you know? And to me, that's less satisfying, I guess, than feeling clever, like, oh, I picked on the subtle hint that they were giving me. Not like, well, they slapped me in the face with a red herring, so how am I even supposed to find my footing here? That felt a little bit slipshod to me.
Right. Well, especially with 70 years of movie-going experience, like, you know, the fact that this is a brand-new genre... Like, mm-hmm. I kind of give them a little bit of pass on the plotting just because I don't think they fully... And, you know, there's, like, just some stupid shit. Like, the fact that this guy stashed a murder weapon on premise mm-hmm. in this secret container of the, like, the clock, like, that I think was supposed to be for its day a mind-blowing reveal, but to my 2018 eyes just looks, like, ridiculous. Like, why? Who the right. fuck would ever do that? And then this guy happens to carry two shotgun shells in his coat pocket so that he can reload and blast the real Laura in the face? Like, uh-huh. come on, man. Come on. But there's a couple of things like that that I thought were the outer workings of the plot were kind of silly, and there's some of that even in the Maltese Falcon. It's just the Maltese Falcon managed to be a little bit more entertaining. I'll tell you another thing that bothers me. Hmm. They really built up this lore to be a hell of a broad, of a dame,
yep.
of a skirt. Like she's like Peggy Olson 30 years before Mad Men. Right. She's an ad executive that she's already yeah. like super accomplished. But when we meet her, I can't decide whether we're supposed to understand that she is a very bright young woman who sees this Lydecker character as the self-important kind of dandy that he is and decides to play into his lack of respect for women just in general. And play the, like, kind of like, oh, I'm just a poor little girl sent here by my ad agency, and I knew they wouldn't work, but I thought, like, she's playing all this, like, that didn't strike me as an impressive, hard-charging, super successful young ad executive.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a game that the two are playing, and I think Laura starts it. You know, I don't actually, like, whether or not the company sent her there to woo Waldo is mm-hmm. I think immaterial. It's like and I actually think it works better if they didn't send her, right? Because she's taking the initiative.
She's
going out there
right
really taking charge of her career, which I think is awesome. And then I do think she correctly reads this guy and she manipulates him into accepting this whatever ad kind of contract thing she's doing, or the endorsement of their pins.
Yeah.
And I think somewhere along the way, you know, Waldo begins to manipulate her, right? And try and trap her into this relationship. And I think Laura is both aware of that and also resistant to it, but also somehow susceptible to it. Like, she gets drawn into this game, even though I don't think she wants to be, and I think she's aware of the game they're playing.
Okay. So let me see if I echo this back. I kind of... Because that's where I was trying to find out a way. It's like, okay, she went here under her own steam to try to land this big client.
Mm-hmm.
And she correctly identifies... So that shows her gumption. But she's still up and coming. Like, she hasn't established herself. This is her taking a flyer. She identifies that the tack to take with this guy is to play kind of like a little bit of a damsel in distress. Or like, mm-hmm. oh, you know better than me. And then this guy essentially makes her career with his column. Mm-hmm. And not just to call him, like, he dresses her, he teaches her about posture and like all this other stuff. Like he constructs her image from nothing. All she is a pretty face that he's, that's the other thing, I guess, is like, they didn't sell me of what is the thing that attracted to him, to her in the first place? Was it just her? Cause the thing is this, Jean, Tierney is a knockout. She's like, beautiful by modern standards. Like, she's just stunningly gorgeous, but there's not like any Audrey Hepburn there. There's no like I didn't feel like there's any like steel or fire underneath the surface the way you do some of these, you know, larger than life female characters in the 40s. And I felt like mm-hmm. they were selling me a person like that, and I was getting a, like, essentially a pretty face that Lydecker has made into his own preferred image, which was not as exciting, I guess, as Laura, the young Spitfire that I was kind of sold on.
Yeah.
But it does seem like it's consistent with the plot and what they were telling us, because Lydecker's an unreliable narrator, and he's saying what he thinks about her and what he thinks, like, I mean, I guess you understand that, like, what he thinks about Laura is a little bit about what he thinks about himself.
Yeah.
You know, Laura's beautiful and she has impeccable taste because he's beautiful and he has impeccable taste, and he's trained her, so why would she have anything other than that?
Yeah, and I think the assessment that, you know, she's his doll or his possession is the most accurate one I could come up with, right? It's not even, like you said earlier, romantic. It's you know, he has created this thing, and it's his, and if anybody comes along and threatens his supreme control over it, he becomes very violent, you know?
Yeah, he, like, and he ran people off. Like, he destroyed people's career with his writing position for the New York newspaper, whatever influential rag he's writing for. That's the other thing that goes, going back to my criticism of the central character, Laura, is, like, she felt very passive. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I don't love this guy. Oh, I guess I love him. Oh, I guess I'll, you know, go against the cops' orders because I want this. I don't want this guy to go to prison. Oh, I love you. No, I don't love. Like, it's like she seemed like she was very wishy-washy and went, like, kind of with the whims of the plot a little bit more than I was expecting. Like, yeah. I still couldn't tell you, does she really love McPherson, or is she scared and he could protect her and get her out of the sticky situation so she leads him on?
Right. It's a fair question, because she comes back from her retreat and I thought, okay, she's got her mind made up. And then the very next day she flip-flops again. And then I think they make that so that, like, I think she's in on a plan at the end with McPherson. I don't know. It's really hard to tell. It gets pretty convoluted toward the end.
And there's also, like, there's like a 1 minute scene of just her and Vincent Price sitting in that car in the rain, which I thought that was a pretty, like, in the day, that was probably very impressive. Like, that looked like a really realistic modern rain scene that I can't remember seeing in many scenes. Like, it was like just like, and you know, the idea they're having this intimate conversation and no one could possibly intrude on because the rain is loud and there's no, like, I thought that some of that stuff was visually striking. Some of the outdoor set work, but yeah, like, it's just kind of, it kind of made her wishy-washy. In fact, that outdoor scene, like, I thought it might possibly be the set that Gene Kelly stomped around on in Singing in the Rain. Huh. A lot of those doorsteps and lantern posts looked exactly the same. I was unable to confirm or deny that in my research, though. So it probably means it wasn't. Because,
yeah, people wouldn't know.
Laura's got an insanely high reputation amongst people. Like, it didn't make the AFI Top 100, but it was nominated for it. Roger Ebert gave it a perfect 4 stars, included it in his list of great movies. It was enshrined in the National Archives as a particularly noteworthy piece of artwork and film. And what's weird about that is I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's like I got an AFI Top 100 bias because I did, you know, way back when, sat down and make a concerted effort to try to see as many of those as possible. So, like, I'm only comparing it unfavorably to other movies of its era that were doing the same thing, perhaps better, like the Hitchcock films, the Humphrey Bogart stuff, seemed like it was a lot of the same ideas and concepts, but better. And also, I guess the other thing this thing is known for is its theme song. Like, over 500 people have recorded covers of this jazz piece, including Frank Sinatra. And it was like insanely popular. But, like, I'm not a big jazz fan, so I didn't get that either. Like, everybody was talking about this haunting theme and all this, and I'm like, I even listened to a couple different versions while I was waiting for you to edit the last podcast to get to this, because I'm like, I'm trying to get into this. I'm really trying, but I'm like, it's just, it sounds like, you know, kind of big band jazz. It doesn't sound haunting at all to me. It actually sounds kind of jaunty.
And that kind of brings me to one of my other, you know, contemporary 2018 criticisms. I felt like the music cues were used differently back then, and I'm not equipped to quite understand what they're doing. Because there are scenes, you know, where the detective's looking around Laura's house, and the music is swelling and falling and swelling and falling, and I don't actually know why, and it's not really tied to the actions on the screen as much as I can tell. There are moments where it is, but they do this ebb and flow of the music that I simply don't understand from a 2018 perspective.
I wonder if that's still transitioned from the silent movie phase where it's like you just had to have wall-to-wall sound because you didn't have anything else. You had to keep the momentum between the title cards. I noticed the same thing. What's amazing about Roger Ebert's review, if you read it, and I encourage everyone to do so because he's a brilliant man, is like his review reads negative because he lists everything that's wrong with the movie. And he even says like the brilliant score, which underpins, and he like says parenthetically, and I mean really underpins in some places, kind of like he's throwing shade. Like he's always like throws out a thing of praise and then he throws a piece as a shade. And like it reads like a 2.5-star review, but it's a 4-star perfect great movie review. And he says all the stuff, a lot of stuff that we're talking about, like the problems of the primary characters, the coincidences, the twists and turns, the final kind of reveal of the villain, and how kind of arbitrary, because like that's the other thing is going into that very final scene, it could have easily been anyone in the room. It could have been, and there's like some other contrived stuff like Lydecker goes in like less than an hour prep, throws a hey everybody, Laura's back and she's alive party just to have an excuse for everyone to be in the room. And also like all these characters just tagging along with the detective in his investigation, like who the fuck lets that? I mean, the one guy's a journalist, so maybe, but everybody else, like, get the fuck out of the room, I'm investigating here,
right?
But like, yeah, like it's easy to see the film, like I said, I can see the charms too, but like to me it wasn't it certainly wasn't a 4-star, what I'd call great movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do, like I said, this movie did not bore me to tears. I actually, I halfway enjoyed watching this movie, right? It didn't thrill me like a modern movie would, but I didn't see it as a particularly bad film, even by modern standards.
There's some dialogue I liked, like towards the end of the movie where McPherson's convinced that Vincent Price hasn't killed Laura. And he makes a comment about, yeah, it's just too bad you weren't the one to answer the door, because it's like there's nothing wrong with Vincent Price. He's just kind of a sleazy opportunist. And he just like drops like crouches down and just punches him right in the gut. And like Vincent Price is so tall, it's almost like straight to the balls. But it's just like so sudden. It's like, yeah, pal, too bad you didn't get your head blown off. Kaplow! Like, I thought that was kind of a little Sam Spade-ish. And I was like, I wish I gotten like 3 or 4 more scenes of him doing something like crazy like that. But coming into that last thing, it's just like I felt like anybody could be the bad guy. So I don't know. It felt kind of arbitrary, which guy it was.
I mean, I've got a lot of other, like, we kind of talked about the big stuff, but I got a lot of other just like comments about the movie. Like you were talking about some of the quotes. One of the quotes that I actually really liked, that kind of perfectly played on who Waldo is when they're talking about him essentially not having any compunction with the things he's doing. He says, "I should be sincerely sorry to see my neighbor's children devoured by wolves," which is like the minimum acceptable level of sympathy to be a human being, I think.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really good. And then apparently this guy, I get it. This guy is at the top of his game, right? He's a journalist who is world renowned for his writing. It's 1944, so I'm sure the journalism industry was much stronger than it is now.
Sure.
1944, this guy is making 50 cents per word, he says. Mm-hmm. 50 cents per word. He's probably a billionaire.
He's got like, because the other thing is he's got that very educated, like, my imagination is he's actually from kind of old money. He's able to afford an Ivy League degree to get him that accent and to get him the clothes and the position to become like, you know, a classic born on third base, thought he hit a triple.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you're supposed to understand that like he's traveling amongst his kind of his betters, I guess.
Yeah. I just couldn't believe what he was making. Mm-hmm. People struggle to make 50 cents a word today.
50 cents a word. That's pretty good for an 800-word column. That's not bad work. But the other thing is, like, he also did radio. Because I also thought, what did you think about the fact that he's like, okay, everybody, listen to my last radio thing.
Mm-hmm.
When he walked out the door, certainly when he recorded the thing, he didn't know that he was going to shoot Laura in the face. But, like, it's the perfect thing to shoot someone in the face to.
Right.
Like a spurned lover kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, I wonder how he intended that to land.
I couldn't tell you.
I don't know.
On a second watch, maybe, but yeah.
I mean, the thing is like, if he hadn't been able to run Vincent Price off, would he have tried to shoot Laura in the face again? I don't know why he wouldn't, because he got away with it this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Anyway, what you said, you had some other things?
Yeah, the other thing I noted is how just fucked up it is what Vincent Price does to this other woman who's chasing him, right? He decides, okay, I don't want anything to do with you. I actually want Laura instead.
Right.
He takes the woman to Laura's house, his fiance's house, in order to tell her that he doesn't love her and that he's going to marry Laura. How fucked up is that?
Pretty fucked up.
Like, this is the place where, oh yeah, by the way, we had our first kiss right there on that couch where you're sitting. That's the thing that really convinced me that I loved Laura and I don't want you, so goodbye.
Yeah, and the other thing about, like, the older woman he was shacked up with, you know, at her comeback party, she's, like, throwing herself at him to be like, oh, you know, forget about that Laura. She's nothing but trouble. And he's just so oblivious. He's like, yeah, but, you know, Laura needs me. And, like, oh, she's like, I'm going to bring Laura a drink. Oh, I could use a drink. Okay, here's a cup. Like, he's just so fucking oblivious. And she's like, mm-hmm. I understand, is, like, kind of his bankroll. Like, you got to keep that bun buttered a little bit, Vincent Price, don't you? But
yeah.
Like, Laura is also super rich, too. So I guess it's more of, like, he feels like he's one of those monkeys that's got his hand on another branch so he can let go of the other one. But he is, like, surprisingly, like, brutal and callous treatment of this older lady.
It did feel weird to my modern eyes, the nature of dating back then. It's very different than it is now, right? I feel like you don't get into a relationship now and be on the cusp of marriage and have to break it off with other people.
Right.
You kind of, like, do your dating. You figure out who you might have a long-term thing with. Mm-hmm. You get into a more serious relationship and break it off then. And then, you know, a year, whatever, down the road, you say, okay, let's get married. And there's nobody to break it off with. Back then, it seemed like, you know, you date a whole bunch of people right up until the very moment you're ready to get married to somebody.
I have... Huh. You really think... So what's your... that you date a whole bunch of people? Because, like, I think Vincent Price is kind of...
he's dating...
Slightly disreputable, right?
Yeah, but I don't think for that reason. I don't think he was disreputable because he was dating multiple people. I think it's because of his loss of his money, and he was just an outcast in the social circles for that.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought that, like, because, like, I mean, this is a lot of Downton Abbey stuff, but, like, you know, this socialite circle, you had a woman's coming out party, I forget what they call that, where she's presented as, like, okay, you can start dating my daughter now.
Yeah.
And then, like, you'd get suitors that would come calling, and your father and mother would essentially reject or promote those based on the suitability of the match, and then... Yeah, like I didn't think, I guess I didn't get the same flavor that you did about, like, the fact that people would, like, essentially hop around up until they get engaged, and I don't know, that the engaged is just kind of like serious dating.
Yeah, it seemed like it to me, but I don't know. Not equipped to talk about that time period, I guess.
Right. What else you got?
That's probably about it.
All right. The other charm of the movie is, because you said, like, you didn't get bored, and I agree, is that, like, the movie does not overstay its welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's, like, just a shade over or under 90 minutes. So, and there's that easily enough plot to fill that time. So, and like, as soon as the film resolves, it's fucking over. Like, we've talked about, like, there's been several movies of late where we felt like have outstayed its climax. Not this movie, man. This movie, as soon as it's done, it's time to roll credits or show the credit screen or whatever they do. So, like, that's another part. Like, you know, if this was a 2.5 hour movie, it would have been a lot tougher of a slog to get through. But as it is, I thought it was interesting to compare it, like the things that like how quickly, that's the thing that's impressive me, how quickly things changed between like 1940 and 44 in terms of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And how, like, you can see again the transitions and the more natural performances, and also how, like, this guy in Hollywood, because, you know, Hollywood's always been more accepting about, you know, non-binary and non, you know, default settings that of everybody. Like that this guy's playing with these stereotypes, but stuff that, like, maybe the American audience themselves wouldn't, like, it's kind of interesting to see how you'd present, like, this kind of, like, closeted gay character or campy gay character, and kind of hint at that without pissing audiences off.
Such a light hint that honestly I didn't even pick up on that. Like, yeah, I get that he was like a fancy lad, but I didn't really understand that he was gay, but maybe.
Well, maybe that's, like, in the parlance of the time, make a little bit too much of that. But I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting to see. To me, like, even when these old movies are not, like, page turners or pulse pounders, which they very rarely are, it's still really interesting to see the technology, not just from, like, the hardware and the standpoint, but, like, the technology in terms of telling a story and realizing, oh, shit, this is a camera. We can do so many things with it. We can do all these different perspectives. And from an editing standpoint and from a dialogue and structure standpoint, it's so cool to see the evolutionary history from this stuff to the stuff that we have nowadays, where film noir can be robots hunting each other down in the streets of a polluted LA city. Like, there's, like, it's completely different kind, but you can still see that spiritual link all the way through them. So that's our thoughts on Laura. Thank you, Sarah, for commissioning this podcast. I apologize profusely, just like I've tried to do with all the commissioners, that it's taken us this long to clear out our queue and get to your project. But thanks a lot for your support of Bald Move. Thanks a lot for having us check out this meaningful and impactful piece of Hollywood history. We'll be back with the next commission podcast. I think it's John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yep.
Is the thing we're doing next. We'll be back with that the next time. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you later.